So take a journey with me this morning to a time and place that's very different than our own. A time where values were different, culture was strange, clothes were scratchy, food was bland and sometimes just bad. Let's go to a place before conveniences and a time when most of the people were illiterate. And royalty was addressed as my lord and my lady, usually followed by a bow or a curtsy. A time before good hygiene, a time before plumbing and modern medicine, when people feared the spirits of the night, they feared the howling wind, they feared those black cats that would walk across their way. A time when life expectancy was short, infant mortality was high, and marriages were arranged. If you grew up in a house where marriages were arranged, who would you be married to today? It's a good question. So let's journey back today to medieval times. And let's pretend today that we're living in a fiefdom with peasants and merchants, with artisans and soldiers and farmers, and of course the high rung of society, the king and the queen. So let's pretend this morning that we are living in medieval times in a beautiful castle in England. And maybe the castle would look like this. As you can see on our castle here, you see primary walls and you see secondary walls. You see turrets on the sides, you see battlements. You see parapets, you see merlons, which are those parts of the wall that jut up in the squares up on top. You see all of those in our beautiful castle. You see over here these little skinny windows that would be very easy for archers to shoot out of, but very difficult for the other archers to shoot into. You can see on our walls that they're tall and strong. It's a good place to live. Most importantly, it's a safe place to live because we trust our walls. And those walls can stop any enemy that comes against us. Now, inside the castle and inside the walls of our castle are other buildings. Some of them you can't see. Some of them are houses. Some of them are simply stores. You can see in the middle of this castle the large citadel in the middle, which would be where the soldiers, the commanders, where we would keep a lot of the swords and the pikes and the weapons that we would use. But of course, the middle of every castle is the palace. And it's really around the palace that the center of our castle life revolves. Now, inside the palace are beautiful rooms, ornate dining rooms that would kind of look like this. And we would host large dinners and we would host dances. We would have conferences and balls. We'd conduct our business of the realm around these tables. And of course, speaking of the table, we would eat well in our castle, inside the palace, at the dining room. We would eat the best of the food that the realm had to offer. And of course, the best of the ale and libations and spirits, because that goes along with the feasting. But we'd have awesome roasted pork, and we would eat mutton, and we would eat wild boar, and we would eat steaks, and of course, the breads and the veggies, the best that the realm could offer to us during our times of feasting. And inside this great hall, inside this great palace, we have impressive architecture that people would look up, and they would see the impressive way that the castle was built and the gables up on the ceilings. And looking at those things would give the people the sense of grandeur, the sense of wealth. They would look at the ornate rugs on the ground, and they would look at the tapestries on the walls, and they would look at the high gabled roof, and everything would say, we are wealthy, we are safe, we are secure here inside of our castle. Now, no castle would be complete without a throne room, and we have a throne room inside of our castle, and this gives that extra emphasis to the power of the king and the queen and the nobles, and everything in our castle society would revolve around a caste system. And in this caste system, the royalty would be at the top, and the noblemen and the peasantry would be at the bottom of society, and they would live very far removed from the king. Well, as with most castles, our castle has its own church and its own clergy. And of course, the king and the queen, they would come in from their own entrance and they would sit off to the side. But if you were a nobleman or maybe even a wealthy artisan, you would sit closer to the platform. And the poorer you are and the more peasant you are, the further back you would sit. I'm not saying anything about people sitting in the back row this morning. So, here we are in our castle. And every castle needs a couple people to make the whole thing work. So, first thing I'm going to do today is I'm going to elect a king and a queen out of the middle section. And I was thinking that maybe Keith and Vicky would be great kings and queens. Would you stand up for me, please? Come on, stand on up. Okay. So I have a couple things that I'm going to bring to you because no king is a king worth anything without his sword. So let's see you wield the sword a little bit. You got that? All right. And you need a crown. So here's your crown to see that on your head. That's good. Stick that thing down. It's all right. And of course, a queen would need a tiara. A Princess Disney tiara. So let's give you the tiara, and it'll go on. It fits my head, so it'll fit yours. It's on there. Very good. Now, you guys stay right there. Okay. So in our castle, the way things work, the way life works, and the way this is going to be divided out this morning, is this middle section, you guys are going to be royalty. You are noblemen. You're not the king and the queen, but you are noblemen. And so if you're sitting in the middle section today, you're very lucky you're sitting in the middle section because you are part of the royalty of our society. And you are the people that have the wealth. And the way you secure more power, of course, is by marrying your sons and daughters off to other noblemen. Doesn't that sound like a great idea, Shayna? What do you think of that? What if mom and dad got to decide which of the noblemen here you had to marry? That would be all right. Lisa's looking around going, And that's what would happen. Where could I find the best deal? Let's make a deal. And that's how it would work here in the middle with our royalty, the noble class. Now, if you're sitting on the first wings over here, you guys belong to the artisan class, the merchants. You guys are soldiers. You guys are craftsmen. So you're not nobility. But many of you are actually wealthier than many of the noble class. You guys are tradesmen and your smithies and your leather workers. You're the ones that really bring the income into the kingdom. And so you guys, on these two wings, you guys belong to that class. You are respected, but you are not honored because you are not of royal blood. Now, the bad news is, if you're sitting in the side wings this morning, you belong to the peasant class. All right, the peasants. Wow, these are some really excited peasants here. They're excited because they haven't washed in a long time, kind of smelly a little bit. So you guys are really the workers. So you're servants in the palace. You're stable hands, some of you. Maybe you're rowers on the tradesman boat. But you guys belong to the peasant class. You don't own land. You don't own your house. Your life is very, very simple. And for the most part, you're happy because you have this very simple life. Of course, you don't get to eat the rich food that the royalty eats or that the artisan class gets to eat. You kind of eat more like gruel or beef stew that maybe would look like this. Still looks pretty good. And the peasants are like, we're far less excited now. And so we all live together in our castle. And we all live together enjoying the harmony that comes along with castle living. That doesn't mean that life isn't hard. And fighting doesn't really happen all that often. It only happens when maybe a noble daughter of a nobleman falls in love with a stable boy on the outside. And then Wesley and Buttercup don't get along, and there comes the scandal. All right? So let's practice just for a second of Keith, if you could raise your sword. All right? And kind of brandish the sword. There you go. Okay. And the count of three, we're all going to say, long live the king. Ready? One, two, three. Long live the king. Very good. Don't hit Tom with your sword. That would be really bad. That would ruin the whole story. All right, you guys can have a seat. Thank you. Let's not forget who our king and our queen really are. So enjoying the harmony of the castle doesn't mean that life isn't hard. And medieval life would have been very, very difficult. Medicine men would have had a very rudimentary understanding of potions and elixirs to try to help those who get sick. And there were a lot of people sick because we live in a castle. And in a castle, the walls keep everything cool. There's a lot of must. There's a lot of mildew. There are a lot of smells. There are rats and bed bugs and fleas that plague everybody, including those in the noble class. And still to this day, in our castle, in our society, nobody has made the connection between health and hygiene. And so when somebody would get sick, we would think it was a spirit. When somebody would fall lame, it was a punishment from the gods in some way. Even our bathrooms, which we call privies, were hardly sanitary because we would often share them with other people, sometimes in a large room, sometimes in a smaller room that would kind of look like this. And that would be our privy. And so maybe you think, well, you know, where does the waste really go? And at times, bathrooms had this kind of a bathroom, which is on the outside of the main part of the palace. Now, if you know your gravity, the waste always falls down. So this would be on the outside of the palace, and it would simply accumulate down along the ground, maybe in the road. And then somebody from the peasant class would every once in a while have to come along and scoop up the nobility stuff and take it somewhere with them, which means that as you would walk along the road, you'd have to be careful where you walked because piles would accumulate, and evidently you shouldn't look up while you're walking along. So you don't have to use your imagination all that much to realize that the sights and the smells of the castle all mix together. So on the count of three, we're all going to take a deep breath so we can enjoy the smells of our castle. One, two, three. And they all mix together in our wonderful castle life. And yet, even though it sometimes smells funny, and there's must and people are sick, inside the walls of our castle, we are safe. And in spite of all this, the safety and the intrigue and the fun around the kings and the queens and the nobles and the artisans and the craftsmen and the peasants on the outside, there's one small detail that I have left out. We are under attack, and we are under siege in our castle. And that changes the story. Outside the walls of our castle, the enemy has brought its entire army against us. And I want you to imagine being able to climb up on the walls and look out in the morning and see the enemy. And you can see the catapults that he brought along. You can see the battering rams that he's about to use against your wall and against your gate. You see the siege towers that he built, and you see the wheels where they will push that siege tower up against the walls. You see those things. And every few days, they attack. Every few days, they come against the castle. And it usually begins with those catapults slinging large boulders in the hopes of bringing down a corner or hitting a wall that would fall, or maybe a lucky shot to hit the gate and they'd be able to get in. Enemy soldiers run at the castle with ladders, hoping to gain an advantage, to take the walls, to get a foothold, to take the castle. And the battering rams, they roll down the road towards the gates. And they have a shield wall over top of those battering rams that are filled with soldiers. And our archers are up on the top of the walls, and they're in those little slitty holes. And we're trying to shoot, we're trying to stop the battering rams. We're looking for weaknesses that we can exploit as we try to stop that battering ram from making its way all the way to the gate. Now, of course, we have boiling water. We have scalding sand that we can dump out and hopefully on top of that battering ram to kill those soldiers, to stop the advance, to guard the gate. Oftentimes, those catapults shoot not just large boulders, but flaming boulders. And they come flying at night, and you can see them arc their way into the castle. They hit, they explode, sparks go everywhere, fire begins. In comes the peasant class, really acting more like a fire brigade to put out those fires, to save the people, to save the castle. And you wonder, in the midst of all the chaos that's going on, you wonder at times, why are they so persistent? Why do they keep on coming in wave after wave? Why do they keep coming day after day? Why are the roads and the fields littered with the bodies of the enemy? And why do they feel like that's okay? Why is it okay to lose that number of people, that many soldiers, to take the castle? And you wonder that because you have forgotten that our castle used to be their castle. Until your king, and our army threw them out. So the enemy that wants the castle, they want their castle back. It's theirs. And they want it back. And they know the castle's strengths. They know the weaknesses. They know its secret doors and secret entrances. They know all these things because it used to be their castle. They know people on the inside. They know the spies. They know the turncoats. And they will do whatever they need to do. They will pay whomever they need to pay. They will bribe whoever they need to talk to. They will try every Trojan horse. They will dam up that river to try to get under the walls. They will do anything they can to take the castle. They will yell offers from outside the walls. Quarter for any who would want to leave. Bribes for any that would give them information. They offer a one-on-one, winner-take-all battle. To save lives, they say. They will do anything to take the castle. It was theirs, and they want it back. And they will do anything, and they will not stop until they do. And there are some days that you and I get up in the morning and we wonder, how much longer can we hold out? We're tired of fighting. Food is getting scarce. There are no longer feasts in the dining room. Attrition in the army is very real as soldiers die, and younger boys must don helmet and sword and armor to go into the fight. Supplies of arrows are thin. Water is becoming scarce. And as our resources get thinner, it seems like the enemy's resources have no end ever. They are bottomless. They can get all the supplies they want. They have unyielding resolve. They have unending resources. And they show no signs of letting up. How long can we hold out? So, welcome to Castle Life. This is our castle, my castle, your castle, and this is the story of Romans 6, 12 through 14. And I want to show you that story, lest you think I just made it up to embarrass Keith and Vicky. I would never want to do that. But it is the story of Romans 6. And I want to read verses 12 through 14, and then I want to show you the words in the text that are part of this castle language that Paul sets up for us to understand his big point. Romans 6, verse 12, says, "Let not sin, therefore, reign in your mortal body, to make you obey its passions. Do not present your members to sin as instruments for unrighteousness. But present yourselves to God as those who have been brought from death to life, and your members to God as instruments for righteousness. For sin will have no dominion over you, since you are not under law, but under grace. So I want you to notice the castle language in these three verses. You can see there in verse 12 the word reign, which makes us think of thrones and castles and realms and crowns. You can see the word obey, and obviously absolute obedience is the expectation of any king for all who live in his kingdom. In verse 13, you find the word instruments in my translation here, but that is actually the word for weapon, translated as weapon in every other instance in the New Testament. So these are weapons for unrighteousness, weapons for righteousness. Notice the word present, and that's the word for bowing down. That's the word for Lord and Master. When a servant would come to a Lord, he would present himself. That's this word. Notice the word dominion. So just like in my story, we have in these verses, we have a kingly throne in verse 12. We have a challenger to the throne, this enemy, this rebel, this thing that wants to be king, wants to take the castle back, and his name, according to Paul here, is sin, and every day he tries to take his castle back. It used to be his. He wants it back, and he won't stop until he gets it back. He is no longer the master of the castle, but he wants that title back. And then there's a castle here called your body. You see that there? Your body. And there are servants here called passions or desires. And at times they want to obey, and at times they don't want to obey, and at times they want to go back to the former master. This is actually part of the word that we use in English for the word surrender. So we have servants that are desires that want to surrender to the enemy. They miss the old king. And the weapons that he talks about here, specifically in verse 13, two times he uses this word weapon, instrument, or tool. He says these weapons are members or parts of our body. The tongue, the sex drive, the fantasy world, your hands, your feet. Paul says, don't let the enemy get a hold of any of your weapons and turn them against the one true king. And there is one true king in all of this. You see, present yourselves to God, the one true king, in verse 13, as in bow before the one true king. So in the story that Paul unfolds here in verses 12 through 14, we have one true king who is God. We have one very real enemy who is the sin and the sin nature and the sin that is trying to get the castle back. And Paul says, stay loyal to the true king with all of the weapons and all of your servants and all of your forces and all of your strength and all of your desires and all of your members. Stay loyal to the one true king. Now, there's one last piece here in the story about this castle, and that's found all the way in the end. And this castle is run by rules. Maybe we could call it the nation's constitution. In verse 14, it says, for sin will have no dominion over you, since you are not under law, but under grace. So in this great nation, this castle runs following not the old ways, not the old laws, not the old constitution, but has been replaced by a new king, new laws, new constitution, a new sovereign. And under this new constitution, there is mercy and compassion and forgiveness and hope and freedom from fear and freedom from a past and a great promise of a great future. And this is our castle. This is our fight. The enemy is real, and he wants the castle back. And so here's what I think Paul's big point in this section is in verse. And I think his point is, hey, what's your plan to make sure the enemy doesn't get your castle? What's your plan? Do you have a plan? Do you think about it? Does it matter? What's the plan? You see, in verse 14, he says that sin is no longer the master of the castle, but in verse 12, he says that he wants to be. And in verse 13, he says, all right, you got some weapons at your disposal. What are you doing with your weapons? What's the plan? What's the strategy? What are you going to do? What's the plan? And if you really believe that you're in a real battle scenario, and if you really buy into this idea that we are in a battle, and if you can follow my scenario, my allegory a little bit here, that this is a castle and we're fighting to keep the castle and the enemy wants to worm his way into the castle in every way that he can. If you can really buy all of that scenario and buy that story, and if you really believe that you're in a battle, let me ask you a couple things. How sharp would you keep your sword? How diligent would your lookouts be in the turrets, in the corners? How careful would you be to see everyone and anyone who is acting suspicious inside the walls? Would your radar be on high for any hint of treason or treachery, watching closely for anyone who would betray? Do you think you'd walk up to the main gates and crack it open and go for a walk in the meadow? Because you have nothing better to do? Would you invite the enemy to come to tea? Just a little sit down. Would you barter away the castle? Would you barter away your friends, your inheritance, all the riches that are yours? Would you give it all away just to stop the fight? Would you skip the council meetings? Would you skip the strategy sessions? Would you ignore the warnings? Would you turn a blind eye to the weaknesses of the walls, those that have been damaged by the enemy? Would you say, oh, they won't come in that way. They don't see that weakness. Would you be passive in the defense of your home? Would you shrug your shoulders like it doesn't matter? Would you skip training because something else is more important? This is our story. And Paul knows the story very, very well. And I think sometimes we believe that we're the only ones in history that have had this battle, that have fought this enemy. And sometimes we forget that we're in a long line, 2,000 years since Christ, of men and women who have had the same battle with this same enemy, many of whom have won. They've conquered. Many of whom have not. So I think what Paul does here a little bit is that he makes some suggestions for us, ways to guard our castle. And I don't want to press my story too far. You know, any example has limitations. But how do we guard our castle? And I think Paul makes three suggestions here. First one, don't ever forget that a fight is raging for your soul. Don't buy into the idea that sin doesn't want to take the castle anymore. Don't buy into the idea that it's no big deal, there's no battle going on. Don't buy that. As a believer, what we've talked about is that you've already thrown off the old master. But you got to believe that every minute of every day, that old master, that old enemy wants the castle back every minute. And is fighting and looking and worming and trying everything he can with all of his resources and everything at his disposal, with every weapon he has to try to take the castle back. Don't ever forget. He wants his castle back, and he will sacrifice whatever it takes. He will pay whomever. He'll torture whomever. He will do anything that needs to be done subtly, overtly, pompously to see the destruction of the castle. And it's so easy, I think, to forget that there's a real battle. And you live day to day and just kind of go along with your stuff, and you forget that a battle is raging for your soul. And that sin wants that castle back and is trying to worm its way into your life. You know, one of the most favorite verses for many of us is 1 John 1:9. If you confess your sin, he's faithful and just to forgive you of your sin and cleanse you from all unrighteousness. But what we forget is that 1 John 1:8 comes before 1 John 1:9. 1 John 1:8 says, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. Sin comes to the battle every day. So just because we have a new master doesn't mean we can let down our defenses, doesn't mean that, oh, we're just not going to do anything. Paul in Ephesians 6 says, remember, your fight is not against flesh and blood. And sometimes it feels like it's against flesh and blood. But he says it's not against flesh and blood. The fight is for something far more deadly than flesh and blood. There is a battle for the soul. So don't forget and don't pretend that there's no battle. Don't pretend you're so strong that no enemy would dare come against you. Don't be so proud to stand up on top of the wall and say, what are you going to do? Because that enemy knows his job, and he's very good at it. I think a second suggestion here is a little bit more subtle, but I still think it's there, and that is conquer Christian fatalism. Here's what fatalism does. Fatalism is just an idea that you throw up your hands and they say, oh, there's nothing I can do about it. That's fatalism. Well, Christian fatalism is the Christian version of that, that says, oh, I'm just a sinner. All I can do is sin. I can't help it. And I would say to that, that you are far more than just a sinner. You are a forgiven sinner. You are a redeemed sinner. You have a new master that promises to help you every minute of every day. And he gives you a helper, the Holy Spirit. He lives within you. He helps you. He guides. He convicts. He shows you. He teaches. He does all of this every minute of every day. He never leaves you alone. And in this new castle and in this new world that we have, we are never condemned, ever, ever before the Master. And I long for this sin-killing passion that the Puritans have. If you've ever read the book by John Owens called The Mortification of Sin, that is a guy who took the battle seriously. And he said, yeah, there's a real battle, but instead of going, oh, there's nothing I can do about it, he says, okay, how am I going to kill sin in my life? The mortification of sin. It's a very somber look in the mirror and say, why is it that some people fight hard and other people just say, it doesn't matter? So I remind you that there are a lot of Christians that are nothing more than a bunch of pansies walking around with no backbone in Christ at all. You are a child of God. You are redeemed forever by Jesus Christ. And because Jesus beat death, these are the verses before, he beat death, he beat sin, his resurrection happened, so our resurrection is 100% certain. So part of what I think he's doing here, he's saying, so be strong, be courageous. Don't give in. Keep up the fight. Don't be a pansy in the background like it's no big deal. Don't be pompous on top of the wall and say, what you gonna do now? Fight. Be active. Be strong. Decide. Come up with a strategy. And never forget that in the end, grace wins. That's verse 14. His third idea here, I think, comes especially in verse 12. Resist all contenders for the throne. That throne belongs to God alone. Present yourselves to God, verse 13. Present yourselves to God. I think it is at this point that we fail most easily. We fail because we don't resist. It's almost like we're up on top of that wall and we invite the enemy to come close. You know, the enemy, for the most part, stays just outside of the range of our best archers. But what happens over time is we invite the enemy close. We crack the gate a little bit to have a little bit of a conversation. And so we lose this sense of vigilance over every aspect and every part of our life. And if we're honest, sometimes we think that, man, sin's a really nice guy. Maybe it'd be okay if he came back, and maybe it'd be okay if we brought him into the palace, and maybe if we displaced some of the nobility here in the middle and had sin come back, that would be okay. Maybe some of the peasants on the outside, they would really prefer the new master. He's a great guy. He seems like a really nice guy. He doesn't want to hurt anybody. Unless you have in your mind this idea that I'm only talking about like gross sins, or Paul's only talking about these gross sins, you know, adultery and stealing and murder and those kinds of things, I want to just remind you that in the book of James it says that the instrument of unrighteousness that you and I have, that's number one on the list, is not adultery or drunkenness or any of those kinds of things. The thing that is number one on the list, the quickest way to unrighteousness, is through the use of our tongue. It's the number one weapon. A whole castle, we read in James, can be set on fire by the smallest spark. And I think, you know, there's a lot of you that are much better soldiers at this than I am, but it feels to me, when I really think about this, that what happens when it comes to sin and cracking the doors of your life and allowing sin in, or standing on the walls and inviting sin to come a little bit closer, I think what happens in reality is that sin attacks us at the desire level. What the word that Paul uses here is the passion level. That's where sin really attacks. And I think Satan really knows that if he can worm his way into the desires of our heart, he not only wins the heart, he wins the whole castle. I read a great quote from John Piper this week. It said, "Oh, that the church, the lukewarm, worldly, half-hearted church, would realize that the Christian life, the only life that leads to heaven, is a life of competing desires." And see, I think the reason he does this is because desire is all about choice. It's about what you choose. It's what you prefer, one thing over the other thing. And if God is to get the glory in our lives in choosing against sin, we have to really believe that he is preferable to sin. We have to really believe that the new master is so much better than the old master. We have to really believe that life is better, the constitution is better, the castle is better, the future is better with the new king, not the old king. And so we choose what is preferable. And we regard God and who he is and his promises and all that he's given to us as preferable. So when Satan attacks at the desire level, in all the battles and all the movies, almost always those big armies, what are they doing? They attack the main gate, they attack the main wall. I think when Satan attacks, I think it's through the back door. I think it's a flanking movement. And I think he maybe distracts with the frontal attack, but the real attack is somewhere else, and it's at the desire level. So we have to choose. And we have to choose things like, should I blow up at my wife? Or should I consciously in my head say, love her as Christ loved the church, grit my teeth, keep my mouth shut? What should I do? Should I click on that risque Google ad that came up in my Google search? It's no big deal. It's just a little click. No one will know. I even know how to take it off my computer. It's just a little thing. Just a little click. Should I watch that thing? Should I listen to that thing? Should I turn my TV off and crack my Bible with my kids? Should I work on controlling my tongue? Or do I really believe that somehow I have the right for anything that comes in here to come blasting out here? Why do I think I have that right? And every day, the enemy attacks the walls, attacks the castle. Sometimes right down the main road, but I think much more often it's through a back door. And Paul calls us here to resist, to purge the castle, to mount a defense. And I think that part of the truth in mounting a defense, and everything I've ever read about medieval castles, and every bad movie I've ever watched about defending castles, the people inside the castle are always far more tired than the people outside the castle. So how do you keep up your strength living inside the castle when the attack and the siege on the outside is day after day after day after day? And I wish I could give you 5 great steps to make this easy, but I think the truth is you got to go to where the power is, and that's the only way you're going to survive. So you actually have to read your Bible. Spend time with the Lord. Come to church. Be a part of Bible studies. Have connections with friends that give you strength inside the castle to resist one more day. But I think there's far too many of us that think we're all alone in the castle and we don't need anybody else. We don't need anything else. And we stand pompously on top of the walls. And then we wonder why the castle falls. So the truth is that if you neglect the castle, it will fall. You will fall. So stand strong, Paul says. Be proactive. Never give up against that enemy who wants his castle back. And the day that you relax will be the day he gets a foothold. And never forget that he is very good at what he does.